On one awful day, he attended the funeral and buried all 10 of his children, 7 sons, 3 daughters. It was at the same time when his business was destroyed and he overnight went from being a wealthy man to poverty. It wasn't too long after that until his own health began to fail and he lived in agonizing pain. To all of this, his wife and friends, in despair, blamed everything that happened upon him and told him that he ought to commit suicide. He then took up a pen and paper and in melancholic poetry wrote the words, "Man that is born of a woman is a few days and full of trouble. He comes forth like a flower and withers. He flees like a shadow." He stood at the precipice of death, looked over the edge where his 10 children had gone ahead of him, contemplated death for himself, perhaps by suicide. And then Job asked what has to be the question of all centuries. Looking over that edge, he asked, "If a man die, will he live again? Will his 7 sons and 3 daughters live again? When he dies, will he live again?" It seems to me that every thoughtful person who has ever lived anywhere at any time has asked the exact same question. Maybe not in Job's words, but we've all at least struggled with the issue. We've all wondered, is there more? Or is this it? Is life simply a quick spin through time and then spun out, it's over with, finished once and for all, and we disappear? Or is there more? Is there something beyond? Is the grave the end so that when the casket lid is closed and locked and the dirt is piled upon it, that is not the last chapter? But there's another day, a new day, something else, more experiences, more pain or pleasure to come. Is there more? If a man dies, shall he live again? I believe he shall. I believe in the resurrection of the body. I believe also that with that belief in the resurrection of the body come 2 very special gifts from God. That belief in the resurrection of the body gives a first gift of hope. A gift of hope for the future that, kind of like a beautifully carved diamond, has within it many different facets. It has the facet of that hope for wholeness. Do you remember the story in the 5th chapter of John of how Jesus walked into a crowd of people, all of whom were maimed? There were some who were blind. There were some who were invalids. There were some who were lame. There were some who were paralyzed. We have only one of the conversations that Jesus may have had recorded there. And that was a conversation with a man who was a paraplegic for 38 years. And Jesus asked him, and I particularly am impressed with the translation of the original language that's given in the King James Version in John 5:6, where Jesus asks this 38-year paraplegic, "Would you be made whole?" I can't imagine but that he had thought about that probably every day of the last 38 years. Wholeness. If only he could walk the way other people walk. If only he could get from point A to point B without having to depend upon someone else to carry him. Remorsefully, he said, "I don't have anybody to carry me." Some of us, probably most of us, don't think a whole lot about wholeness. The thoughts that have monopolized our minds the past week have had to do with the economy and with the election and with the weather and with people at home, with friendships and wondering about what we're going to do at Christmas time and what kind of winter we're going to have this year in Minnesota. And wondering if we ought to be married, or wondering if our marriage is going to last. Wondering all the things accept wholeness. Probably very few of us have given much consideration at all to the matter of walking or talking or the ability to see or to hear. We've forgotten that for a large number of people, the prospect of wholeness is something that simply is not a part of their lives. That there's nothing that they can do. That any dream that they've had of some medical intervention to correct their situation has long ago disappeared. That for them, there is no hope, there is no dream, there is no likelihood of being able to see or to hear or to run. For them, there is no changing of the color of the leaves because they can't see. For them, there will be no crunch of snow underfoot this winter because they cannot walk. For them, there is no melodious sound of music. The pipe organ this morning would have been dumb to their ears. To those people, is that all there is to life? Either the wish that they could be like someone else who is whole, or the resentment that life has given to them a horrible and permanent blow, that there is nothing to look forward to but the grave and the end of it, at least as far as wholeness is concerned? No. Because for them, if they also believe in the resurrection of the body, then they have a hope that is the most precious hope of all. It is the hope for wholeness, that Jesus Christ offers that wholeness with a resurrection body to come. That in heaven there will be no wheelchair ramps. That in heaven there are no hearing aids. That heaven's library does not have a single copy in Braille. That heaven is a place for wholeness when all that God designed us to be is put back together again. It's the truth that is written in 1 Corinthians 15, 42 and 43, where wholeness is spelled out. So it is with the resurrection of the dead, the Apostle Paul writes. What is sown is perishable, what is raised is imperishable. It is sown in dishonor, it is raised in glory. But listen to this. It is sown in weakness, it is raised in power. The power to see, the power to hear, the power to speak, the power to walk, the belief in the resurrection of the body gives us a magnificent gift, the hope for wholeness. But there are other facets to this diamond, the diamond of hope. There is also the hope for holiness. Every serious Christian has at one time or other struggled with that command of 1 Peter 1:16. You shall be holy, for God is holy. And we're stunned by it because we know that we never ever measure up to that holiness of God. And so a battle rages within us, a battle of which we are more keenly aware on some days than others, a battle that is pitted against our higher desires to experience that holiness of God and our more base desires that seem to be dragged along by the flesh until we identify, sometimes painfully, with Paul's words in Romans 7 when he writes, "For I know that nothing good dwells within me, that is, in my flesh. I can will what is right, but I cannot do it." Ah, but he who believes in the resurrection of the body believes that with that resurrection of the body comes the reality of holiness, that we shall be just like Jesus Christ. And we can hang on to that hope for now. We go back again to 1 Corinthians 15, that basic of all chapters in the Bible on the resurrection of the dead, and discover there that while we now have a body that is essentially defined as a physical body, then we shall have a body that is essentially defined as a spiritual body. It is raised up a spiritual body. And then in verse 49, we read that just as we have borne the image of the man of dust, that physical life that we now struggle with, we shall also bear the image of the man of heaven. You want to know what it's going to be like? Sin will be conquered. In that resurrection body, you can throw in any saint's face any temptation, the worst that you could ever imagine, and multiply it as many times as you like. And there will be no succumbing to that temptation. There will be no giving in. There will be a perfect and uninterrupted fellowship between every resurrection body of every saint and God himself. There will be a perfection that really now we can't define because we can't begin to understand. We will be perfect as God is perfect. We will be holy as God is holy. So that belief in the resurrection of the body gives hope for wholeness, but also for holiness. And add to that a third facet of this diamond of hope, and that is the hope for happiness. I think just about everybody has thought at some time or other what we would wish if we had an Aladdin's lamp or if an angel would suddenly appear to us one morning and offer to us any dream come true. We probably think that we'd flippantly say, well, I would like $1 million or $1 billion, or I would like my health back, or I would like some other specific thing. But then when we reflect upon it, we say, no, really, if I could have a single wish come true, it would be a wish for happiness. Because the health and the wealth and the fame and the power are really only routes to the destination of happiness. And so that's the dream for which we all quest. But for too many people, there isn't much happiness in life. Life deals lots of really tough blows. We have dreams that someday we'll make it and someday everything will fall into place. But then we step out of the dreams of childhood into the realities of adulthood. And we find that that dream, like a balloon, is popped by the pin of death or disappointment or divorce or discouragement, maybe even death. How very many people have silently, if not out loud, said, all I want in life is a little bit of happiness. I mean, doesn't life owe me that much? Why can't I have just some happiness? Is that too much to ask? I'm not saying that I have to be on the cover of Time magazine. I'm not saying I have to visit any exotic places. I'm not saying that I should have anything specific. All I want is a little bit of happiness. Am I being too bold and asking for too much? Do you know that Jesus was painfully aware of human sadness and the absence of human happiness? He did a great deal to turn people around from lives that are sad to lives that are happy. But he promised even more in a resurrection that is yet future and a life in heaven. I like the way he put it as recorded in Matthew 5:12. To people who were sad and unhappy, he said, rejoice and be glad, for your reward is great in heaven. God will give to us a resurrection body that he has custom designed to fit the happiness of heaven. It's a body that, while related to the body we now have, will be sufficiently different that it is able to take in pleasures and ecstasies that now would knock us over. Things that we really now, you know, just can't grab hold of because they're so different from today's life. In fact, happiness then will be at such a peak that if we were to graph heaven's happiness at its nadir, at its lowest point on the graph, it will be infinitely higher than the highest peak of happiness that today we could imagine. Going far, far, far beyond anything that today we could want. We will then have a joy for eternity that will look back upon today's sadnesses and difficulties and heaviness and brokenness and misery. And we'll see those as only distant memories that we know were real somewhere back in time, but now all but forgotten. Now, I know there's a temptation to say, yeah, but that sort of pie in the sky by and by, that sort of holding a carrot out there in front of us horses and saying, well, we'll get you through the muck and misery of now by offering you some sugar cube at the end of the road. No, it's not that at all. I believe that God makes a fantastic difference in life here and now. We'll talk about that next Sunday morning. But it's not just for here and now. He gives to us a prospect and a promise for the future that is a marvelous gift, a hope that changes the way we live here and now. In that day when saints shall come up out of the earth and back from death, in that day, all kinds of marvelous things will happen. We'll be reunited with those that we love that have gone on before us. We'll have our worries disappear. We will have day after day after day when there will not be a fear to muddle things up. We will enjoy the fun of heaven that'll make Fantasy Island seem like nothing, nothing at all. It'll be so good, so great. Belief in the resurrection of the body offers to us hope for wholeness, hope for holiness, and hope for happiness. But it's still hope, you say. Oh, I like the hope, but it seems so far away. I just can't wait. I need those things now. Do you remember when you were a child and you looked off into the adult world? And it seemed then as if the pleasures of being an adult were so distant that they never could be touched. You know, the great things in life, like being able to stay up as late as you want. I've never understood why children want to stay up as late as you want, and then as soon as you're old enough, you're too tired and you go to bed early. It just seems like one of the great ironies of life. Or I remember my father telling me when he was like in his 50s, he said, it just strikes me every now and then that I can go to the refrigerator and take out whatever I want. It's my refrigerator. I can eat it if I like. All those feelings from childhood when mother said, oh no, you can't have that. It's between mealtime. I remember when I had 1,000 days to go before I get my driver's license. I counted them back and started marking them off. 1,000 days until I could drive. And in those days, the days were longer. I don't understand how it worked that way, but no doubt about it. All I had was hope. The hope that someday I'd have a car and someday I'd have a driver's license. And it seemed to me as if everybody had a car and everybody had a license. I remember riding next to my mother one day, whom I was never impressed that she could drive better than I could, whether I was 13 or 14 years old or not, and said, you know, Mom, it just doesn't make sense. I should be driving. And she said, someday you'll be able to. Just someday. 1,000 days. They'll never come. And then they came. Now I'm old enough to drive, and it's been many, many years and many, many miles and many, many cars. And I look back, and those 1,000 days seem as if they passed in a split second. What seemed so long and what seemed like only hope, when reality came and when hope was fulfilled, all of it seemed to change. And so it is that today's yearnings for wholeness, for holiness, for happiness, the dreams to come true that seem as if they will never come true, will one day seem as if they were only seconds that were from an eternity long ago. Because God gives to us now the hope and then the reality of wholeness, of holiness, of happiness. What a gift. What a gift from God. But there's another gift that comes with this belief in the resurrection of the body. It is the gift of a perspective to the present, for right here and now. For example, it's a perspective that comes when we realize that death is no longer the ultimate threat. When you trace back through the history of human thought, you find that there are lots of different camps that people can divide into. Two of them have to do with the question of whether or not there is life after death and whether or not there is a resurrection. It was an issue in Jesus' day. When you read through the New Testament, you repeatedly come across two viewpoints, those of the Pharisees and those of the Sadducees. The Pharisees believed that there was life after death and a resurrection of the body. The Sadducees did not. And so that was the watershed. That was the dividing line between them. In Acts 17, when the Apostle Paul climbed up Mars Hill in Athens and got into conversation with all the Greek philosophers and thinkers that gathered at that intellectual center, they heard him out and listened well until he got to the point of resurrection, life after death. And then a lot of them shut him off. They make fun of him because that didn't fit their philosophy. The issue has not been resolved as far as mankind is concerned because it's still hanging around today. Today we have materialists who say that the human body is simply an accumulation of cells, we are just matter, that when we die, that's it. We're like a fish or a dog or a cat or a bird, that's over, it's done with. And then there are supernaturalists, biblicists, who say that's not just it. There's more to come. There's life after death. There's a resurrection body that God will give that lasts forever. Now, to the Sadducee, and to the Greek philosopher, and to the modern materialist, death has become the ultimate threat. Because when you die, there is no more pain and pleasure. When you die, there is no reversing. When you die, you're kaput, finished, over, done. It's the end. That means, then, that death is a threat that must be avoided at every possible juncture and at every reachable cost. Ponce de Leon was famous for looking for the fountain of youth, but what he was really looking for was immortality. And so those who believe that there is no life after this one must seek out during this life, as long or short as it may be, and at best it's pretty short, immortality. Hang on as long as you possibly can. And then with that comes a fear of death that is paralyzing. It's terrifying. The thought of being told that you have a terminal illness. For some people, the idea of riding in an airplane or coming to any point of danger, of going out on the roads when they might be slippery and death is a possibility, of making that transition from life to it being over and done with. But as Christians, we have an entirely different perspective. We do not have to live constantly in terror, because to us, death is not an ultimate threat. Because for us, we have the belief and the hope, the conviction, the guarantee that death is not all there is. That there is life yet to come. There is a resurrection ahead. To us, death is merely a transition into a far better body and a far better life. So we can't be threatened by it. Now, the marvelous part of this is, when we no longer fear dying, is when we are free to start living. When that death threat is no longer like a dark cloud always casting its shadow wherever we walk, then we can step out into the sunlight and enjoy life and all its fulfillment and all that God has for us. Belief in the resurrection of the dead, it changes our perspective in life. We're no longer threatened by death. In fact, we might even go so far as to join in chorus with the Apostle Paul in Philippians 1:21 when he says, and he seems to go to hyperbole, "For me to live is Christ and to die is gain." It's better. Just the opposite of death. To die is a better life, a better way. Belief in the resurrection of the dead gives a greatly changed perspective on the way we live. Add to that a second perspective that has to do with today's decisions. Because today's decisions determine tomorrow's destiny, and they become tremendously important. When we believe that there is resurrection life after death, and we realize that all eternity depends upon this life, then the decisions of this life become hugely important. When I was a high school student, I attended a youth conference at Houghton College up in New York State. And the speaker at that conference was Jim Voss, a name that some of you may be familiar with. I remember how he summarized a talk that he gave. It went like this. He said, "Decision determines direction. Direction determines destiny." I suppose I was about 15, 16 years old. Don't remember all else that he said. Wow, that grabbed me. That the decisions that I make as a 15-year-old will determine my direction for life, and my direction for life will determine my eternal destiny. That seems kind of disproportionate, doesn't it? That when you're 15 years old, one Thursday afternoon, you make some decision, and then you live with the consequences of that decision forever and ever and ever and ever and ever and ever, 100 billion trillion years and then more. Ah, but when you believe in the resurrection of the dead, when you believe in the resurrection of the body, then this life's decisions become immensely influential, infinitely important. What are the decisions that you make? What are the decisions that you've made lately that have to do with spiritual things, that have to do with a relationship to Jesus Christ, that have to do with what you do with this life? Well, if you really believe it in this resurrection of the body business, then you know those decisions must be submitted to God's rule and must be made right because they determine ultimate destiny. A third and a final perspective change that comes has to do with investing for eternity. Because when we believe, as 1 Corinthians 15 teaches us, that there is a real resurrection of the body, then we begin to invest in a different perspective for all the years that are to come in heaven forever. Paul sums it up in some really pointed language in 1 Corinthians 15. He puts it this way in verse 32. He said, "If the dead are not raised, let us eat and drink, for tomorrow we die." Or to put it in street language, you might as well live like hell, because that's all there is. Why not? You might as well have a good time and not invest for the future, because there is no future. But if you really do believe in the resurrection of the body, Paul says that then, in verse 58, you ought to be steadfast, immovable, always abounding in the work of the Lord, knowing that it's in the Lord that your labor is not in vain. Ah, well, that's different then. In heaven, in our resurrection bodies, we will receive rewards and responsibilities that are in relationship to our life of stewardship here and now. It's kind of like when you're looking forward to retirement. You can either spend your wad today, or you can hang on to some of it, and then you have a different style of retirement. Well, you can invest what you've got now and have a different style of heaven. How do you invest? Well, what are some examples? Maybe it's involvement in Christian ministry. Maybe it's prayer. Maybe it's fellowship in the church or joining the church or teaching a Sunday school class or financial stewardship in terms of missions or other aspects of the ongoing of the work of the Lord. Or it's discovery and implementation of a spiritual gift or it's compassion to other people. But all of that, when we really believe in the resurrection of the body, is seen as investment for heaven. Hey, that raises a tough question, though. If you're thinking it through, you say to yourself, no, wait a minute. You get into heaven totally on the basis of the grace of God claimed or appropriated by faith. And now you're saying, when you get into heaven, your rewards and your responsibilities are tied to your stewardship of what God has entrusted you with in this life. How do you put those things together? How do you make them mesh? Maybe an example will help. At the United States Air Force Academy, just north of Colorado Springs, they have, at best, an interesting tradition. And that is that when they graduate, the cadets, they receive their diplomas in order by class rank. So that means if you've got the best grade point average for 4 years at the academy, you march across the platform first. And if you have the lowest grade point average for 4 years, you come across the platform last. Everybody cheers for the last guy. Personal opinion, alphabetical order is a far smarter way to go. And when they graduate, all of those cadets are then commissioned as officers, as second lieutenants in the United States Air Force, all the exact same rank in the same military of the same government, exactly the same. But you know as well as I do that the cadet who is first in his class is going to receive far greater rewards and responsibilities and promotions and all kinds of things throughout his military career in comparison, or at least possibly in comparison, to the cadet who is last in his class. So there's two things that are true at the same time. Everyone gets the exact same rank in the Air Force, but it's not the same either. It's the same and it isn't the same. As far as heaven and the resurrection body is concerned, when we are promoted to heaven, we all receive the same rank of a resurrection body. Absolutely everybody. But in heaven, God entrusts us with rewards and responsibilities that are directly related to the stewardship of life and all that we have when we were here on earth and when we lived as Christians. That means then that your belief and my belief in the resurrection of the body means a call to living for God today that invests for tomorrow. And today's so short, and tomorrow is forever. I believe in the resurrection of the dead, and that gives to me hope. Hope for wholeness, hope for holiness, hope for happiness. But it's not just then, it's today as well. It gives to me a perspective so that death is no longer an ultimate threat. It gives to me a perspective that today's decisions are mighty important because they determine direction, which determines destiny. It gives to me the perspective of living for God now as an investment for eternity. In recent years, in the summertime, our family has vacationed in a place called West Yarmouth, Massachusetts, which is on Cape Cod, not too far from the more famous town of Hyannis. Part of our summer routine every year is to visit some of the cemeteries in the Cape Cod area. Now, that may not be your idea of a vacation, but sort of different things for different people. And as you do that, you learn all kinds of history. For example, you find that you have to take the face of the tombstone and make sure it's on the leeward side rather than the windward side, because if it's on the windward side, the salt and the sand will take all the lettering off. And they used to turn, the people they didn't like, they turned their gravestones so that they would face the ocean. And then 5-10 years later, there was no mention of them any longer there. Well, we'd go and visit these cemeteries, and you learn history that goes back to the 1600s and tells how people died, and you see infant mortality and how difficult a life it was, all those things. But what always touches my heart more than anything else that I see each year as we do this on Cape Cod is how many of the gravestones around all of the lettering that tells about the people have carved into the face of the stone a hand with a finger that is pointed upward. They, like I trust like you, say by that, this isn't all. It's not just here. It's not just now. I believe in the resurrection of the dead. I have a hope for tomorrow, a hope that is clearly tied to Jesus Christ. Not just at death, but now. That's the way to live. Emblazoned, carved across our lives, a finger that points always upward so that we live today in the prospect of tomorrow, saying with a heavenward glance, I believe in the resurrection of the dead, made possible through Jesus Christ, our risen Lord. Let's stand to pray. Now, Father, we've said that we believe it, but we've had trouble before, all of us, in taking the words that we say we believe and then living accordingly. God, give to us an extra measure of your grace that we may live in accordance with this belief. Lord, give to us that hope, a hope for wholeness, for holiness, for happiness. Give to us the gift of a perspective that is based upon a finger that points heavenward, a hope for tomorrow. And may we not just say, but may we live with the perspective of those who believe that we shall one day be raised again. We believe in the resurrection of the dead.